Joining me back on the program today is David Stein, sometimes called David Cole. He's one of my favorite black sheep. I get all the black sheep on this show. And we're not going to talk about the Holocaust or World War II today, maybe. We're not going to start off with that anyway. David's been writing for Taki Magazine, and he shares my appreciation on bashing Pam Geller as well. But we do want to talk about a free speech issue and maybe a little bit with Mike Rivero as well. And you can tell the story in a bit. And, I don't know what to say to the kind of a tizzy people are having about, on the one side, you have people who think Sharia law is going to take over the United States. And you have the other side apologizing, saying terrorists don't exist or what have you. And we have a kind of conundrum here where people, of course, want to support free speech, but is there really a line that ought to be drawn? Is it offensive to, you know, show up with in front of a mosque with a gun and so forth? So, David, welcome back to the show. I'm dying to hear your opinion on all these things.
Well, thank you, Ryan. It's always a pleasure. And the draw Muhammad thing is the subject I first got into heavily. Back when I was editing a different site in 2009, I was editing a site that was a Breitbart spinoff. One of the Breitbart writers had broken away and started his own site called yesbuthowever.com. No need to try to go to that. It has long been taken down. In fact, I believe it now forwards straight to CNN. When I started editing and also writing for yesbuthowever.com, that was when the Draw Muhammad controversy was really starting to become well-known worldwide. It had been a controversy in parts of Europe, I think from as early as 2006. But in 2009, it was becoming much more well-known globally as an issue. And a lot of people who had never even thought about, is there a problem with drawing Muhammad? People were now being made aware of the controversy. In fact, as many people before me have pointed out, South Park did an episode with Muhammad as a character years before the controversy, and nobody said anything. I think it was either in the late 1990s or early 2000s, South Park did an episode where Jesus and Buddha and Muhammad and a couple other religious icons are kind of like the super friends, and they go around solving crimes. And the episode came and went, and nobody paid any mind to it. But so by 2009, it was becoming...
And you froze there for a second, David, so got to go back a little bit. So you were talking about solving crimes like the super friends.
So for a while, nobody really knew much about the Draw Muhammad controversy. And then around 2009, that's when it began to get noticed. And I believe it was 2010 that it got a tremendous amount of notice because of the South Park episode where they were going to bring Muhammad back. Actually, it was a South Park episode where they were making fun of Family Guy, they were making fun of a cartoon show being censored for drawing Muhammad. Actually, yeah, that would have been before 2010. So when I was editing yesbuthowever.com, there was an incident in the Pacific Northwest. There was a woman, very typical Pacific Northwest lefty kind of hippie cartoonist. I don't actually recall if she was in Portland or Seattle, but she wrote for one of the big weeklies in whichever city she was in. I don't even recall her name. It shows you, Rye, I always prep for these shows. I do a lot of prep work and I print out a lot of notes. I'm always Johnny on the spot, ready to go.
It's because you don't have a drink. That's why I don't remember.
I 5 years ago, that would have been right there in the forefront of my mind to remember a name like that. But anyway, this woman up in either Seattle or Portland did a satirical cartoon about Muhammad that was not making fun of Muhammad. It was making fun of the controversy. The cartoon was called Draw Muhammad Day. And it's just a bunch of household objects saying, I'm Muhammad. No, I'm Muhammad, like a toaster or a spoon or a plate. Muhammad is not shown at all. It's just a bunch of inanimate objects. And the satire was that what does Muhammad even look like? And it might as well, for as much as we know, might as well be a plate or a spoon or a waffle iron. Anyway, she started to get this cartoonist up there in the Pacific Northwest started to get tremendous amount of death threats, and she was targeted in at the time Al-Qaeda was putting out a very glossy news magazine that was spearheaded by some of its Western-born and raised members, and this cartoonist was targeted in there, and she actually felt the need to do something that I had done back in the 1990s, which was she dissolved her identity and became someone else, left her cartooning gig. I was interviewing her off and on during those days, during that week that this all went down. And I felt a certain affinity for her because of what she was having to do, the whole change your name, get into a different line of work. It's never clear if Al-Qaeda or anyone would have actually come after some hippie cartoonist in Portland or Seattle. But I can tell you from having been in a similar position, the fear that you feel is very real.
Yeah, why roll the dice, right? I mean,
yeah,
someone's crazy enough to write, yeah.
All of a sudden, every little noise at night is magnified in meaning when you have something like that over your head. You hear a branch breaking outside, you hear footsteps, could be a jogger, or it could be someone to kill you. It's just the mind thrives on that fear and magnifies the danger and the threat. So back with that publication I was with in 2009, I published several of the Danish Muhammad cartoons, the ones that the newspaper Jyllands-Posten in Denmark had run, that had been one of the catalysts.
The one with the bomb on the turban or whatever.
Yeah, I believe there were 12 altogether, and all of them, they ranged from the bitingly political, like the bomb on the turban, or one in which Muhammad is he has kind of a crescent halo over his head that looks like devil horns if you see it from a distance. So there were the ones that were very political, but then there were the ones that there was one that was simply a wise old man in the desert, and then there was another one that actually was just showing a cartoonist at his desk drawing Muhammad. So it was a drawing of a cartoonist drawing an old man, and then there was another one that was just a stick figure. So they ranged from the ones that were political and inflammatory to ones that would be perfectly acceptable in any newspaper, except for this belief that you can't depict Muhammad in any way. As the controversy escalated and it became part of, in the United States and in Western Europe, it became part of the general dialogue about Islam and assimilation, this thing about not being able to depict Muhammad in any way, even respectfully. I always likened it to the fact that among Hasidic Jews, you're never allowed to write down the name God. Hasidic Jews will usually write the letter G, then a dash, and then the letter D. Now that's their thing. That's what they do. If that's what they want to do, that's what they want to do. But I would certainly be the first one to fight and to oppose it if there was any type of a movement, big or small, that would prevent people who are not Hasidic Jews, people who don't buy into that, that would prevent them from writing the word God. I think being able to write the word God is a right that we all have, and I would fight against anyone attempting to take that away. But the Islamic thing has, the Muhammad thing presents a whole ream of different rationalizations for why people have shied away from drawing Muhammad or presenting drawings of Muhammad. One of them is 99% of all Muslims are peace-loving peaceniks, but you know, you don't want to inflame that 1%. Why do it? Why make the... Or then there's the rationalization. No, no, it's not that. It's that if we inflame them, it could harm our troops overseas. You inflame that 1% of the nasty ones, and they could bomb it, some troops. They could cause trouble there. Then there's also the one, no, no, why make them feel not welcome there? We should all feel welcome. And if they don't like drawing Muhammad, let's not do it so that we can be welcoming and giving and loving of our immigrant friends. Every rationalization that can be given simply falls flat to me, because Muhammad is a historical figure. He's a figure in history, world history. He has been influential. No one would deny that. Certainly Muslims would be the last ones to deny that. They name 90% of their kids Muhammad. And Muhammad has had great influence in the shape of the world as we know it today, and in the shape of the world as it is continuing to change. In that, he's a historical figure. Therefore, he is no different than Buddha or Jesus or Abraham Lincoln or the Egyptian pharaohs or anybody. He belongs to all of humanity. Doesn't mean we all have to believe he was a prophet or that he was supernatural in any way. But when you take something off the board in world history, when you say, well, this can't be touched, because either you're going to upset someone or offend someone, or you might be risking your own life and limb, or you might be putting someone else's life and limb at risk.
Well, to me, maybe not you, but a lot of the people who are saying they want to draw Muhammad however they want, and who cares if it offends somebody, are the same group that get their panties all in a twist if somebody's walking on the American flag or burning a flag. And to me, freedom of speech is freedom of speech. If somebody wants to draw a prophet, they can. They know it's going to piss people off. If someone wants to burn a flag, they can, but they have to know it's going to piss people off. Just because something's legal doesn't mean it's smart, but I definitely agree it shouldn't be illegal. I mean,
well, the thing is, I'm in a unique position here, right? Because on the one hand, as you very accurately pointed out, there are the people who are all gung-ho about drawing Muhammad, but then who react to any real or perceived desecration of the American flag with outrage. So
see,
there are
their
those
symbolism people. Matters. Someone else's symbolism doesn't. You know, see a little bit of hypocrisy there. It's like, why do you care about it? Like, well, because it's their religion. And if somebody drew Jesus, you know, having butt sex or something, it wouldn't go over very well. Like,
yeah,
wouldn't.
But and then there are the people on the other side who are sympathetic towards banning or at least not drawing Muhammad, and they always bring up the thing, well, but there's, what about the Holocaust? Oh, we're it's freedom to draw Muhammad, but it's, we're not allowed to speak of the Holocaust. What makes me uniquely qualified to comment is, number one, I have been throwing Holocaust revisionism in people's faces since I was about 20 years old. Mm-hmm. So I can't be called a hypocrite on that score. And regarding conservatives, when I was with the GOP and when I was a conservative activist, I not only opposed people like Pam Geller, but even long before that, I wrote an impassioned defense of the Supreme Court case that made flag desecration legitimate free speech. Before 1990, states could enact laws that put you in jail for desecrating the flag. And when that changed, when the Supreme Court case established that desecrating the flag is legitimate speech, political speech that cannot be banned, I have consistently been one of the defenders of that decision, because and in fact, whether you like Justice Scalia or not, and people have very strong views about him, but you read his decision in the flag burning case, and it's beautiful, because he's very impatient with people who don't see his point of view. He's like, well, of course it's political speech. Burning flags has been political speech from the dawn of flags themselves. And he's very he's dismissive of the people who would who wanted to ban that type of speech. And I remember reading that decision back in 1990 and saying, good for you. That's it was the kind of thing where Scalia was actually the swing vote on that. A couple of the liberals on the court, I think Stevens, one of them, if I recall correctly, a couple of liberals on the court wanted to continue the flag banning policies, but it was the right decision. And we have to, one thing we have to always keep in mind, Ryan, the world that we live in, the world that you have a lot more familiarity with, and I had to get to know when I started blogging and technology or what have you. But in the world of today, there's outrage, and then there's the need for constant blog hits. A lot of the outrage that you see in conservative sides, liberals too, but for the moment we're talking about conservatives and things like flag desecration. A lot of the outrage that we see coming from conservative circles every week for this story or that story, it really has to do with coming up with an inflammatory headline because you want blog hits. Mm-hmm. I hate that whole environment, not that it's 100% new. Newspapers were always doing that in the old days as well, and so was TV news. But it's a lot bigger. There's a lot more of it now that everybody has a blog.
Well, that's how Geller and Spencer would do things. They'd run an inflammatory title and make sure they had a question mark at the end so they could get away with it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Entirely. And
is Rick Perry promoting Sharia law?
Yeah, question mark.
Rick
yeah,
Perry, like, well, we can say he is.
We're asking the question, is yeah. all. And so, with that, there is a lot of outrage that you see on all sides because the blogosphere and the world currently as it is encourages manufactured outrage. That's the best way to get someone to click on a piece. And if you're one of those people who monetizes their site, that's a big deal. That's part of your income right there.
So porn is illegal for Google AdSense because that's a big attraction too. But race baiting isn't. And I've seen a lot of that too. And you wrote about this as well. Race snipers. Turning every police conflict, every shooting, any act of violence is racism. It has to be race. And there are people who are going to click on that to argue against it, and there are people who are going to click on that to, you know, megaphone it. And it's I'm not sure if these people are really sincere or not or just trying to boost their blogs, but I think a lot of them actually believe their own shit.
Well, I think they do, and I think that the problem is that they're no longer constrained by editors. In the piece that I wrote that you mentioned, the reason I use the term race baiting snipers is that a lot of these bloggers, I call them snipers because they're not trying to engage. They don't want to full on engage the other side. They want to take a shot. Yeah. Yeah. And they want to take a shot, and then they want to hide and reload. Now, back in the – and I give this anecdote in the piece in Talkies magazine. Back in the late 1990s, when the LA Times and a lot of those newspapers were still more in the game than they are now, you could always go to an editor. And I kept very good relations with some of the editors there because I was a published author for a while in the Times. And I knew all the editors of every section by name. And so if a journalist, a reporter, a commentary person at the LA Times tried some of this nonsense, you could always call up one of the editors and say, you know, I don't think this is right. And it is going against your stated duty as being the paper of record for Los Angeles and your public responsibilities, blah, blah, blah. And the editors actually could get involved. They could get in the mix and they could change things or answer questions that the cowardly journalist didn't want to answer. Now with the blog world, there is only a tiny modicum of editing that goes on. Even at the very, very big sites, like Huffington Post and some of its mirror images on the right. The bloggers, they have a lot of leeway because these sites thrive on constantly updated content. Every 24 hours has got to see tons of new content on the sites, or the sites stagnate and they don't, and the hits fall, and you don't get the same Alexa rating, and so you have to set your ad rates differently. So because of this need for constant updated content, the editors just let a lot of stuff go. And so a lot of these race-baiting snipers who post these inflammatory pieces about so-and-so news stories, this is proof of racism, this is proof of white privilege, this is proof of the sickness within the white race, this is oppression, this is that. They get to say it and they move on because, again, part of that 24-hour news cycle is that by the time they've posted that piece and it's gotten its peak amount of hits, they're on to another one. And their editors don't even care about the piece that was on the day before because that's long forgotten in the blog world. 24 hours is like a year. It's like, oh, you're still talking about that thing from Wednesday? It's Thursday now. Come on, get with the game. At the very least, in the days of the old newspapers, you had one issue per day, and a lot of work had to go into that issue. And every issue was like, when you would put it to bed, you'd feel a certain sense of accomplishment. Well, another day's issue is done, and you'd have all these editors who had worked for 24 hours, and they would all start again the next morning. There wasn't really the constant updating. Then one, little by little, each one of these newspapers started their own sites and would put stories up before they would even get into print. Because, of course, we all know the print newspaper industry is dying, a very painful and not terribly slow death. So in the piece that I wrote, I gave an anecdote about a woman who wrote for the LA Times back in 1999, who did an abominable and unproven piece full of accusations of racism here and racism there. And she wouldn't answer any of my simple questions. So I contacted the associate editor and actually got an interview with her to answer some of those questions. And I bring that up to date to today, to all of the stuff that has been on blogs recently regarding all of the race baiting stuff. I mean, every time someone is shot, and I'm not saying that, you know, I'm not a always 100% support the police kind of guy. A lot of times, police misconduct, it definitely has to be called out, and there's always there are going to be instances definitely where race is, it matters, and race is important in why a particular guy is treated a certain way or shot. But now it's become the cause celeb to yell out racism in every single instance, even when black people are not involved, like the brawl or whatever it was. I think we're still figuring it out, but the Waco, bikers, Texas bikers. Yeah. There were very few, small amount of black people involved in that, and yet still race got dragged into it because the bloggers were like, well, if it had been black people brawling, we would have gotten the National Guard called in and the whole site would have been bombed. And I wrote to a bunch of these people who made accusations. One guy in particular, the Huffington Post, who made that National Guard analogy. I said, well, to the best of my understanding, the biker brawl, as violent and bloody as it was, only lasted a couple of minutes. By the time the first National Guardsman would have gotten suited up and on the road, would have been long over. And plus, there really was no reason to call in the guard for what was seen as a police action, right or wrong. And as I said, we're still figuring out what the hell happened, and we're still trying to figure out, of those nine people who were shot, how many were shot by fellow bikers, how many were shot by the police. But I contacted a good dozen people who made outlandish claims in the wake of the Waco biker brawl, and none of them none of them got in touch with me. And in fact, the race and ethnicity writer for the Associated Press, a guy named Jesse Holland, he bragged on his Twitter feed that he never feeds the lions, which he then says he defines as answering readers' comments. I think it's especially appalling these days that a guy with the Associated Press, the wire service that most newspapers use and rely on, somehow is hostile to the idea of corresponding with his readers. And the fact that this guy is very far leftist is even more ironic, because what is more elitist? And he's like, he's probably one of these guys who would say, I'm fighting against the 1% and their elitism, down with the elitism of the white privileged 1%. Well, what is more elitist than saying, I'm not going to answer for my columns. I'm not going to answer for anything that I write. You take what I write and treat it as manna from God.
But it seems like that makes it less defendable, because if they're doing it for ratings, if they're trying to get more blog hits, then answering questions and getting an argument started would get them even more hits, but short term, because it would be over, because they'd lose that argument. And so they don't want to engage in it, which means they know what they're saying isn't true, and they don't want to try to defend it.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think they're more than comfortable with getting that 24-hour cycle of Facebook shares, Twitter shares, hits, and they don't want to defend. I mean, one of the people I contacted, Sally Cohn of CNN, who's well known for many, many inflammatory statements from a racial point of view that she has made, and the only thing on her Facebook page you think she brags about is when her columns get her on the air, because she's a CNN. She writes for CNN.com, but occasionally she's on the air, and that to her is the victory. It's like, oh, this got me on the air. This got me, but you know, in an insulated format at CNN where she doesn't have to answer any hard questions. And so that's her idea of victory. Lost in all of this muck is the old-fashioned notion of trying to shed light on things, whatever your perspective, right or left or anything in the middle, but trying to shed light on things instead of just continually trying to get hits or get the gold trophy of being invited on air for 7 minutes on CNN in the middle of the day, or maybe the real gold for someone like Sally Cohn, which would be you get 7 minutes on the Rachel Maddow show, and that's worth popping the champagne for. But it's taken us very, very far afield from what journalism in theory is supposed to be. Now, some will say in the old days it was, others say no, it was never
show a couple times.
Yeah.
But when I go on air, and it's usually not American media, I have been on CNN, I've been on MSNBC, but it's usually, oh, like the Russian or Iranian networks or something. But I have to answer their questions. I don't even know what they're going to ask me, and I'll defend whatever I'm saying. But when you watch CNN or a lot of these, it's like two sides of the same coin talking to each other, and nobody challenges them ever.
Of course, yeah. Yeah, it doesn't
kind of like
bring
presidential debates. They don't debate. They take turns answering the same question.
It sheds no light. Yeah. It sheds absolutely no light on anything, and nobody is really forced. I mean, someone in your position, you will sometimes be hit with hard questions the same way that I was. And I know from my perspective, in the days when I used to do news shows and talk shows, I know from my perspective, I liked being hit with the hard questions. I felt that that's what gave me the opportunity to prove my case. Mm-hmm. These days, no one invites me anywhere anymore. In fact, a very, very quick anecdote.
That's why you're on this show.
Yeah. Well, no, very quick anecdote for you and your listeners. This I won't say the name only because I'm still hoping that this can happen. But a few weeks ago, actually by now over a month ago, I was bumped from the radio show of one of the most controversial and politically incorrect figures in the media. This is somebody who is very disliked, not for the same things that I'm disliked for, but very disliked, very controversial, very hated, I would say. The kind of person who has hit, there have been boycotts against him when various media outlets have thought about hiring him or using him. So this guy bumped me and told me that I was too hot to handle for him. The analogy I made, I spoke to the guy, you know, I know him to an extent. I mean, I'm familiar with him. And I spoke to him the day that he bumped me. We had a very nice phone call, and I said something along the lines of, getting told by you that I'm too controversial is kind of like being told by the elephant man that you've got a big, fat, ugly head. Like, wow, really? You're saying that to me. Holy crap. And so there was a, that was actually, though, getting bumped from that and then
Do you take
being
that as a
told by,
badge?
it's a badge, but it can get a little disheartening. Because at the same time, like for example, and again, I won't say the name because it might happen, but there's one very, very major newspaper that one of the top 10 newspapers that has been saying they're going to be doing a piece on me, a fair and objective piece, since November last year, and here we are, it's the beginning of June. I have answered 75 emails from them asking for more detail about my views and asking me questions. Good questions, by the way. That email exchange that I've had with this newspaper itself could be an essay, because it's never, I don't think it's ever going to come to print. I just don't think it's ever going to. I've put in the time. They've put in the time contacting me. That's what a lot of people outside of all of this don't really know sometimes is that there's a lot more going on behind the scenes than you know if you're not there. I in the last month I've fielded questions from a good dozen mainstream publications, and it happens almost every month to one extent or another. But it never goes anywhere because even if you've got one journalist at the paper on your side, you've still got a structure above that person who can say yes or no. That's of course, that's the bad side to the old newspaper structure. At least with today's blog structure, it's easier for stuff to be seen and heard, even stuff that is controversial, even stuff that might be foolish, can still find an audience somehow. But when you go back to that old newspaper structure, that there is a whole boardroom of people who can turn thumbs down to a story, even if one of their respected journalists really likes the story. So I guess my point really was it's disheartening and funny though. And the minute that I get the sense that the radio thing will never happen, because I still think it might, but the minute I sense that get the sense it won't, I'll certainly talk about who the person is and the irony of it being this particular person. But I always try to remain optimistic
I think I
and not
already have a video about this guy, but
off air, I'd like to hear who you think it is, and I
right.
promise I will tell you if you're right or not.
Okay. Yeah, I'll tell you off air.
At Takis Magazine, they give me pretty free rein, except they have asked me to cool it on the Holocaust for a little while. I don't think it's because of fears they have or concerns. I mean, about the controversial nature of that. I think it's more that that they want their magazine to be consistently varied, and they don't want anyone to become a
Mixed in the
one
thing, yeah.
pony. Yeah. So I do have some stuff coming up. And in fact, another thing exclusive to your listeners here, I have a great piece about Rand Paul that's an exclusive piece of information that no one in the media has. Now, I have shopped this around to a larger journalist, to a journalist with a very big publication. It's up to him at this point whether he wants to run with it or not. If he does, well, then you'll read about it in the papers and you can say, ah, good old Dave is. You'll know that it's me because it references some things that I'm very well known for, especially to anyone who's read my book. So if it does make it to the mainstream press, you'll be able to say, oh, that's the thing Dave was talking about.
Your
And
book,
if it.
Republican Party Animals?
Yes.
That one?
If anyone who's read Republican Party Animals will be familiar with something from that book that that will factor into the Rand Paul story. And but if the mainstream journalist decides not to run with it, then in about a week and a half from now, that'll be my next Tacky's magazine piece. It's very hard to get mainstream conservative sites to link to Tacky's, mainly because there are people who, like me. It's a place where people who are controversial, people who I like, John Derbyshire, who I think is a very good writer, who was fired from National Review for, I don't think, reasons that merited being fired, and Jim Goad, an author who I've known since 1991,
I like Justin Raimondo on there. He's been on Talking for a
yeah.
while.
Justin Raimondo was on there for a while. Judge Napolitano writes for there occasionally. Paul Craig Roberts. It's a good mixed bag, but it sometimes can be a little too hot to handle. Every couple of weeks, I can get a mainstream site to link to one of my pieces. And I think that's a great victory. In fact, I always think that I must have tricked them in some way, like found some rube at the Blaze or Newsbusters or somewhere who doesn't know what Talkies magazine is. You know, I never want to take advantage of someone's ignorance, but every now and then I like to think, aha, I've and in fact I did something on the leftist side of things about a month ago. I had a piece that I really wanted to get mainstream publicity for. It was a Talkies magazine piece that included my mattress fortified underground bunker bit with the Playmate of the Year, Kennedy Summers. And I wanted a lot of people to see that because I wanted it to go viral. But I knew, you know, how am I going to get anyone to carry it? So I included one key sentence in the piece that was inflammatory, that was not really the way I would normally write. But I figured those 8 words in that sentence would be enough to get the liberal press's attention. And it did. Those 8 words in the piece got my piece on Salon.com and Wonkette and Gawker and Alternet and a bunch of the left-leaning sites.
Did you feel
The guy at Wonkette, it's not all women there. A lot of people make that mistake that everyone at Wonkette is an et, but there's dudes there too. The guy at Wonkette was able to wring 2 pieces out of criticizing my piece. Now, I was happy about that because he links to it every time, so it got hits. It helped the video go viral. But the guy at Wonkette also said some really interesting things that I wanted to debate, I wanted to discuss. So I emailed him. His name's Marty Kelly. He goes under the name at Wonkette of Dr. Zoom, but he says his name's Marty Kelly. In other words, I'm not giving away private information here. He always says what his real name is. So I emailed
It's not
Dr.
Dr.
Zoom.
Zoom.
It is not Dr. And by the way, that's Dr. with a K. Dr. Zoom. And I emailed Dr. Zoom and I
He
said, hey,
wanted Dr.
thanks.
Doom and he wasn't allowed to steal the Marvel name.
Either that or every Dr. Doom possible
Spelling
email
mistake,
was taken. Yeah,
yeah.
like every Gmail with Dr. Doom underscore, Dr. underscore Doom, they were probably all taken at that point. So I emailed him and I said, let's talk. You said a couple of interesting things in this piece that I would love to privately discuss with you. And not a word. I must have emailed him five times, not even the smallest courtesy of a reply. And then I had to let him know. And I hate doing this because I don't like embarrassing people. But then I had to let him know that I fed him the story. That he had tips the guy in his piece who fed him the story, like, you know, we got this from so-and-so. And I said, you know, so-and-so is me, Dr. Zoom. I sent this to you because I knew that you wouldn't be able to resist wringing a bunch of stories out of this piece. So, you know, it was, you've been talking to me all along.
So-and-so is me.
and every time I do that, I know that I've lost that person for the future. In other words, I could never feed them a story again. I did the same thing to the Daily Caller. On the right side of the spectrum, the Daily Caller used to routinely carry my stuff. Then they decided not to when I was outed, and I was kind of upset because, like, well, the Daily Caller was always on my side, and now the Daily Caller acts like I'm a pariah, like I'm a leper. So I
because
started
of your opinion on a historical event.
Yes, purely because of my opinion on a historical event that had been expressed in the early 1990s up
right.
until my outing had not even been expressed again.
And you're so not allowed to change your mind once you've said something.
Yes.
You know,
oh, yes.
You can't.
I locked into that. So I started feeding the Daily Caller pieces about me, but posing as someone who doesn't like me. And I would feed them stories, and they'd eat it up. They got like three anti-David Cole pieces in the Daily Caller, but the last one was based on pure nonsense. The first two anti-David Cole pieces were actually based on things that I thought, you know, would be legitimate stories. I mean, I didn't see them as negatives, but I knew that the Daily Caller would see them as negatives. But the third story was based on pure nonsense, and yet they ran with it. And then I got to humiliate them by going to a different site and saying, you know, the Daily Caller just ran a piece that is complete fabrication from this David Cole guy. And so I was able to play Raw Story and Alternate against the Daily Caller. People might say to me, my God, what the hell's wrong with you? You're worse than a World of Warcraft guy. You're sitting around there thinking you're some freaking general moving pawns when you're just a dude in a t-shirt drinking heavily. And my answer to that is simply, I don't get a lot else to do because I don't get any legitimate media interest that ever actually sees its way through. And all of last year, all of 2014, when my book came out, it was just one massive waste of time after another of dealing with reporters, giving lengthy interviews, giving honest, straightforward interviews.
We sold you some books, I know.
Oh, well, that's why I love doing this show, because you let me have my say. And the thing also I love about you, Ryan, is even when you and I disagree, it's always, we're always friendly and we can talk again after it, which, I mean, to mention Michael Rivero, that's the opposite side of that coin. I never had an issue with the guy. I did his show one time last summer, and I believe you were kind of instrumental in bringing
that
about.
I set you up with like four different shows. Unfortunately,
yeah.
I don't think they let you talk as much as I do. But
yeah, it's – well, I mean, that's a good or a bad thing, depending on whether one
yeah,
likes
it. Yeah, maybe I should stop you sometimes. But, no, you know, it's your – if it's a discussion, it's a discussion. If it's an interview, then I'm kind of quiet and I'll let the – you know, the person I'm interviewing, that's who needs to talk most of the time.
By the way, I just want to say the hardest thing about when I had to edit the piece that I did with the Playmate of the Year – was I had to sit there listening to the sound of my own voice so much. And I just kept cutting bits and bits out of it because I'm talking so damn much throughout the piece with the Playmate. And I wasn't thinking about how the audience would really much prefer hearing her speak than me.
Well, you're used to being interviewed, not giving an interview, like doing the interview, right? So.
Yeah. And she was also a little, I think she felt confused by everything that was going on around her. I don't mean confused by me. She knew who I am, who I was, and who I am, and she knew what we were there to do. But it was a totally strange and different thing for a woman who is Playmate of the Year and usually has her media appearances pre-planned for her by an entourage from Playboy.
Hey,
So.
next time I'm at your house or in LA, you have her back over and we'll show her some real magic. Not just your coin trick.
Well, you're the master at that. I mean, I showed the one trick that I know, but you are an actual professional at that kind
No
of
one
thing.
knows
So
that
yeah.
stuff. Although there's another guy in LA who's better than I am. His name is Rich Manley, and I'm hoping to bring him by sometime so you can see some of his stuff. I was stumped on several things he did. I figured it out eventually because I'm OCD like that, but I was shocked. You got to see it, but we'll do that. But yeah, so I'm sorry that that happened with Rivero. I didn't know he was do that. We disagree on things, and I don't really consider him censoring me because it's his site. He doesn't prevent me from putting it on my own site or whatever else, but things that we disagree with, he usually won't let me post it on his site. But then when I post something else, he hasn't banned me or anything. Once it's something he likes, it's back on the site again. No hard feelings or whatever. But yeah, there's certain things that we disagree with vehemently, and he's just not going to give that a voice. But then it's his website, so he can do what he wants with it, I guess, you know.
Well, I think what upset me about what happened with Rivero is my modus operandi with anything like that. I always reach out to the person first with complete respect. And I mean, I can be, especially when I've been drinking heavily, I can be very foul-mouthed in some of my Facebook comments and such. But and a lot of times I'm that way with people who I know how to take it. But with
Yeah, that's
someone
how
like
our
Rivero,
arguments are
yeah,
on
exactly.
Facebook.
That's just how I get. I get that way, and the people are
I'm just
tolerant.
laughing and be like, put it down and push his button some more. Sometimes I
I
argue on Facebook for the sake of the audience. It isn't me. I ask stuff that I know they want someone else to ask, you know? And I already know what you're gonna say. I don't give a fuck.
but with Rivero, since I don't know him beyond that, the time that I did his show last summer, and we had a brief email exchange before and after the show. Other than that, I don't know him. So when he removed a comment, a very non-combative comment of mine from his from a thread, I
Now, that
emailed
might
him.
not have been him. It could have been a moderator, just saying.
But here's the thing: I emailed him in the most understanding, non-threatening way possible. I emailed him privately at his private email address, and I said, "Michael, I'm just curious. Was it you who removed that? And if so, I'm just curious why." There was no chest puffing. There was no sense of righteous anger or indignation.
What
It
was
was a
the
very
comment towards? Tell people.
it goes back to yeah, it goes back to the Muhammad cartoons where I was simply making the point that he had posted a meme that likened drawing Muhammad to calling an entire room full of black people the N-word, and I was making the point that I thought those.
And I'm sorry, that's our time for today. 50 minutes for the free version, for the hour and 11 minute version, and the answer to the topic we just got on, and more. Please become an ANC member. All you have to do is sign in with your username if you have a recurring payment on PayPal. If you are having trouble signing in, please send me your username. Just hit contact and send me what your username is. If you forgot what it was, just make up a new one. I will match it with your email and we will get you set up for the next 2 months. It's only $5, or you can donate whatever you want. You're welcome to donate more, and you'll certainly have your membership. And please do spread these around. This is how we pay for this. This is how I pay for my films.
Dedicating the JFK film to Michael Collins Piper. May he rest in peace. He passed away Saturday. I'm very sad about it. We all lost a great researcher there. And hopefully I can finish it soon. I regret that he wasn't able to see it. Of course, we have the anniversary of Robert Kennedy's death tomorrow, June 5th. And I will have a small video about that as well. All right, take care, ANC members. I appreciate your support.